Well, as you know by now, I am something of a history nerd, and there's a really interesting conversation that goes on within the study of history. It goes like this: Is world history determined by a few brilliant people, like great men, or is world history shaped more by socio-political and environmental factors? You know, a lot of us probably grew up in schools where the great man theory of history was taught, where it was the great men who drove world history. The idea here is that there are these unique individuals who, by the power of their own charisma and force, were able to shift the course of world history. So guys like Charlemagne and Napoleon and George Washington and Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela, these are great people, great men who have had an enormous impact. And I don't mean to say that women haven't had an enormous impact either, but historically this has been called the great man theory. So the argument goes that these people have uniquely shaped history by the force of their own character. Now, that was 1800s that theory kind of was founded or was codified into a scholastic idea. But since then, a lot of people have started to question that and to say, well, hold on, there are always these larger socio-political forces at work that cause things to happen. And had those so-called great men never existed, the same things would have happened anyways because of what was going on in the culture of the time. So the idea is that had MLK and Mandela never existed, the things that they did still would have happened because of forces at play. There may have been somebody else riding that tidal wave of history, but it still would have happened. That's sort of a socio-political environmental view of history. So what do you think? Would World War II have gone the same without Churchill and FDR and Charles de Gaulle and Mackenzie King? Would we have handled COVID the same way that we did if Tommy Douglas had never existed? Are we driven by the aspirations of great men, or are we carried along by forces that are greater than any one person? I'd like to suggest to you that there's actually a third option, and that option comes from Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2 tells us that we are not moved along by the whims of powerful people. We are not carried along by the random impersonal forces of society. Rather, we are given direction by a good, compassionate, sovereign God. So let's go to Daniel chapter 2, and I'll tell you why I say that. Daniel chapter 2, you can head there. Remember Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations is in there. Ezekiel, that's a big block in your Bible. And then right after that is Daniel. So Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2 begins in the middle of the night. King Nebuchadnezzar, the great king of Babylon, has had a dream, and it has freaked him out. Right, that kind of dream where you wake up and think, was that real? It sure felt real, and it unsettled him. You know, he tried drinking some warm milk. He tried reading a book for a while. He tried counting camels, but he just couldn't get to sleep because he was so worked up by what it was that he had dreamed. So in the morning, first thing in the morning, he called to all of his wise men and scholars and philosophers magicians and enchanters and sorcerers. These are, by the way, the guys that would have showed up at Jesus' cradle in Bethlehem at Christmas time. Not these people in particular, but this sort of person, astrologers and wise men, they, you know, got the call from the palace, threw on their robes, and headed into King Nebuchadnezzar's to see what they could do about this unsettling dream. So they came into the presence of the king, and they said, verse 4, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will interpret it. Verse 5, the king replied to the astrologers, this is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me what the dream was and interpret it, I will have you cut into pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble. But if you tell me the dream and explain it, you will receive gifts from me and rewards and great honor. So tell me the dream and interpret it for me. Classic carrot and stick, right? The astrologers and magicians must have thought, wait, did he just say that? He'll rip us to pieces if we don't tell him the dream, that we have no idea what it is, or reward us if we do? And so they just repeated themselves again. Verse 7, once more they said, let the king tell his servants the dream, and then we will interpret it for you. That seems like a reasonable thing to ask. Well, verse 8, Nebuchadnezzar demonstrates himself to not be very reasonable because he says, listen, I am certain now that you are trying to gain time because you realize that this is what I have firmly decided to do. If you do not tell me the dream, there is just one penalty for you. You have conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping the situation will change. So then tell me the dream, and then I know that I can trust the interpretation, is essentially what he's saying. Let's talk about this. Why is Nebuchadnezzar acting like this? Does he remember the dream? Has he actually forgotten it? You know, there's some scholars who will say that's what's happening. He has legitimately forgotten what it is that he has dreamed. He just remembered that it frightened him, and he wants the wise men to tell him what it was. I mean, that's possible, but I'm pretty sure that Nebuchadnezzar does know what the dream is. Right? He's pretty shook up about it, and to be this worked up about a dream you forget, I don't know. Verse 9, though, drives it home, I think. This is a test, right? Verse 9, you have conspired to tell me wicked things, hoping that the situation will change. You know, I didn't mention this earlier, but look at verse 1. This is just the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. He is still consolidating power. From history, we know he had an expansionist sort of policy that did not make everybody happy, and he is hardly a democratically elected king. And so I think that this is Nebuchadnezzar trying to find out who in his court is loyal to him. The dream just happens to present a good way of testing. So really, I think Nebuchadnezzar's got two goals. One, figure out the dream. But two, figure out if he can trust his wise men. So he says, tell me the dream and its interpretation, you get riches. If you get it wrong, ruin. Classic carrot and stick. The astrologers, though, realize that that's practically impossible. Right? Verses 10 and 11. What the king asks is too difficult. There is not a man alive who can do what the king is asking. How's that for foreshadowing? This, of course, just made Nebuchadnezzar all the more angry, and so he demanded that all of the wise men in Babylon be put to death. And, of course, who has just graduated from Wise Men University of Babylon, head of the class? Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Right? The guards come looking for them. And verse 14, Daniel responds to them with wisdom and tact. And again, I think that this is God working in the hearts of the guards and the executioners to give them favor. Because instead of just whacking their heads off, the guy stops to explain the situation with the dream. So Daniel asks for more time. He's just, hold on, just give us some time. And he goes to talk to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Notice verse 17 here, the narrator is using their Hebrew names because they are about to talk to Yahweh, the Hebrew God. And they pray that God would intervene and spare the lives of their own lives, but also the lives of all the other wise men, so-called, in Babylon. Verse 19, we see his prayer. During the night, the mystery was... we see the feedback from the prayer. They have prayed, and during the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. So Daniel discovered what the dream was about and what it meant. And then Daniel praised the God of heaven and said, verse 20, "Praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons. He sets up kings and deposes them." Remember that. "He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. He reveals deep and hidden things like the dream of a king. He knows what lies in darkness. Light dwells within him. He says, 'I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and power and have made known to me what we asked you. You have made known to us the dream of the king.'" So Daniel went into the presence of the king, and the king asked him in verse 26, "Are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and what it means?" And Daniel says, this is key, verse 27, "No wise man or enchanter or magician or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries." The wise men were right. There is not a man alive who could tell the king his dream. There was a God in heaven, Daniel's God. Verse 28, "He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in days to come." Underline that. This is a vision of what is to come after Nebuchadnezzar's time. He says, "Your dream and visions that passed through your mind as you lay on your bed are these." Verse 31. "You looked, O king, and there before you stood a large statue, an enormous, dazzling statue, enormous in appearance. The head of the statue was made of pure gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron, partly of clay. While you were watching, a rock was cut out, but not by human hands. It struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and smashed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, the gold were broken to pieces at the same time and became like chaff on a threshing room floor in the summer. The wind swept it away without a trace. But the rock that struck the statue became a huge mountain and filled the whole earth." So that's the dream, right? In his sleep, Nebuchadnezzar saw a statue, head of gold, torso of silver, belly of bronze, legs of iron, feet of mixed iron and clay. And then there's this stone, cut not by human hands, that crushes the statue to bits. The statue is gone. The rock, the stone, becomes a mountain, fills the whole earth. Okay, so Daniel's got part one, right? He's got the dream. Part two, the interpretation. Verse 37, "You, O king..." Just got to make sure that it's not... Okay, good. Every once in a while, someone will text and say, "The screen's not working for us." Verse 37, "O king," Daniel says, "you are the king of kings. The God of heaven has given you dominion and power and might and glory." Remember verse 21? God is the one who sets up kings and deposes them. He says, in your hands he has placed mankind and the beasts of the fields and the birds of the air. Wherever they live, he has made you ruler over them all. Daniel says to Nebuchadnezzar, you, king, are that head of gold. And I'll bet that made Nebuchadnezzar breathe a sigh of relief, right? Because maybe he's thinking that this statue is another king coming to take him out. Or maybe the statue represents a coalition of nations coming to destroy him. But no, he is the head of the statue. And he's a head of gold. You don't get much better than that. Daniel continues, verse 39, after you, another kingdom will arise, one that's inferior to yours. Next, a third kingdom of bronze will rule over the whole earth. Finally, there will be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, for iron smashes and breaks everything. And as iron breaks things to pieces, so it will crush and break all others. Just as you saw that the feet and toes were partly baked clay and partly of iron, this will be a divided kingdom. Yet it will have some of the strength of iron in it, even as you saw iron mixed with clay. This kingdom will be partly strong and partly brittle. So the various metals represent various kingdoms. Okay? Each one coming one after the other on the heels of Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. What about the rock? Verse 44. In the time of those kings, the kings of iron and clay, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another kingdom. Right, the silver kingdom is going to swallow up Nebuchadnezzar's. The bronze kingdom is going to gobble up the silver one. The iron's going to take the bronze. But that's not going to happen with this final kingdom. It will crush all of those kingdoms and bring them to an end, but it itself will endure forever. Verse 45, this is the meaning of the vision of the rock cut out of a mountain, but not by human hands. A rock that broke the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold to pieces. That rock represents a kingdom established by God that will grow to fill the whole earth and not be destroyed. Daniel continues, the great God has shown the king what will take place in the future. Right? Verse 28, this is what is to come. The dream is trustworthy, and the dream is true, and the interpretation is trustworthy, Daniel says. And then verse 46, King Nebuchadnezzar fell prostrate before Daniel and paid him honor, saying, surely your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you were able to reveal this mystery. I mean, Daniel has just told him the dream that only Nebuchadnezzar himself should know. And he's just in awe of Daniel and his God. And so he makes Daniel ruler of the entire province, head of all the wise men in Babylon. That's going to be important in chapter 6. And at Daniel's request, his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, became administrators of the province of Babylon, while Daniel remained at the court. Now, I've heard sermons in the past where the preacher will say, okay, the main point here is that God is the great revealer of mysteries. And Daniel was right to give God credit for what God had done. You know, they're right. There is no way that Daniel by himself would have known the king's dream or the interpretation. And verse 30, Daniel says specifically, look, God alone has revealed this to me. He's not going to take credit for what God alone can do. And Daniel was absolutely right to do that. Absolutely right to have humility that honors God for what God alone can do. I think, though, that there is more to this passage than just that, right? This passage is not just about Nebuchadnezzar's mysterious dream. It is about what that dream tells us about kingdoms. You know, Nebuchadnezzar's dream was not just about hypotheticals. It's about how things would happen, how the world would unfold. Remember, he says twice over, this is things yet to come. And those things did come. You can actually map the statue onto world history. Babylon was the first empire in the dream. It was the head. Nebuchadnezzar and his successors ruled for a while, but then along came another empire. They're actually going to come within the book of Daniel. Persia came along, the silver chest, and it swallowed up Babylon like a hungry lion. Persia was the apex predator for a while, but then along came Greece with Alexander the Great at the helm. They swallowed up Persia and spread across the face of the earth. The Greek kingdom looked like it was going to last forever, but wouldn't you know it, there was an iron kingdom yet to come, Rome. They conquered Greece, they conquered Macedon, they conquered Israel. Like, if you lived in the Mediterranean at that point in history, you belonged to Rome. But in the time of the Romans, the rock appeared, just like the dream said. The rock crashed into the Roman Empire and began spreading all across the face of the earth. You know, the great leaders of history are gone and forgotten. I mean, you know Julius Caesar and Caesar Augustus. But how many of you know Marius and Sulla and Camillus and Corvus? Do those names ring bells? They're the greatest men of Roman civilization, and yet you don't know them. They're blown away like chaff. God's kingdom, though, was established, spread through the whole earth. On the back of the rock who is Jesus. Right, verse 44. In the time of those kings, the kings of the Romans, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. It will not be left to another person. It will crush those other kingdoms, bring them to an end, but it itself will endure forever. Do you remember when Jesus was born? What's Luke 2 say? In the time of Caesar Augustus, king of Rome. What was Jesus born to be? The king who would reign on a throne forever and ever. His kingdom will not end. Remember, Gabriel says to Mary, Jesus is that rock, cut out not by human hands, which smashes the aspirations of prideful men and then grows to fill the entire world. Jesus' eternal kingdom will not be left to another. It will not be gobbled up by a successor kingdom. You know, Babylon was swallowed up by Persia, was swallowed up by Greece, was swallowed up by Rome. God's kingdom will stand forever. And that, I think, is the key point to this passage for us to take away. The powers that be will not always be, but God's kingdom will reign forever. Right? Kingdoms come and go, rulers rise and fall, but the rock remains forever. John Golden Gay puts it like this: the shape of history is under God's control, and the coming of his kingdom is certain. So let's stop and think about what this means for us for a second. The great man theory of history would say that the world is driven by the desires and goals of charismatic and extraordinary people. The sociopolitical view of society, of history, would say that we are driven by these impersonal forces. But Daniel 2 tells us that there is a God who is in control. As he says in verse 20, there is a God who changes times and seasons, who sets up kings and deposes them, who gives wisdom to the wise and who dwells in moral purity and in light. History, the course of our lives, according to his good and perfect will. That means that we are not defined by the short-sighted plans of the imperfect plans of short-sighted people. We are not carried along by the random happenstance of impersonal forces. Our destinies are determined by a wise and benevolent God. Rulers come and go. Ideologies rise and fall. But God rules over them all, working for good in every time and every season. Maybe you don't like the way that Justin Trudeau or Rob Ford are handling COVID-19. You know what? They're not going to be here forever. God is ultimately the one who is in charge. Maybe you're feeling alarmed by the gradual de-Christianization of society. That's not going to last forever either. That ideology is going to come and go. Only God's kingdom can last, and because of Jesus, we are citizens of that kingdom that will last forever, and his kingdom cannot be shaken. The powers that be will not always be, but God will reign forever. To conclude, let me just think with you for a minute about how this would have sounded to Daniel and his friends in exile. Okay, because I think that that helps us to think about how we should hear this. You know, sometimes we're in such a hurry to read a Bible passage and apply it to our own lives that we forget to think about what it would have meant to the people who first heard it. Right? How did this strike Daniel and his friends? How did this strike the very first people that read off of the papyrus that Daniel wrote on? Let's get into their heads. They were in exile, far from home in a foreign land. In the case of the people who first read it, they were probably just back from exile in a promised land that needed a lot of fixing up. Either way, they're minorities, right? Displaced people living in foreign lands. They had no social power. They had no roots going back five generations or more. They're probably feeling a little depressed and discouraged, knowing that in many ways they were powerless in the society that they lived in. But then along comes this dream. The powers that be will not always be, but the kingdom of God will reign forever. That's adrenaline for the soul, right? A reminder that it's not always going to be this way. This too shall pass. And in God's sovereignty, God's children will arrive in God's kingdom. And God is leading us there every step of the way. I hope that that will give you confidence and wisdom and hope, the same strength that it would have given to Daniel and his friends. Because the powers that be will not always be. God's kingdom will last forever. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for this message. Thank you for Daniel and his faithfulness to stand before the king. Thank you for the way that you answered Daniel's prayer, for the way that you miraculously reach in and reveal mysteries in his time and now. But thank you even more for the picture that this gives us of your eternal kingdom, one that cannot be shaken. God, I just can't get over this, but that we are not ruled by, our destinies are not ruled by tyrants, or by imperfect people. And our lives are not determined by accident. Right? The random forces of political power do not ultimately shape who we are. You do. And you, in your goodness and benevolence, are preparing us to dwell in a kingdom that will last forever. Jesus, you are our King, our rock. And we build our lives upon you. Help us to. And we pray in your name that you would make it happen.